This is Endocrine Feedback Loop. I am your host, Chase Hendrickson, and welcome you to this Journal Club podcast series brought to you by Endocrine Society. Thanks for joining us as we explore an important article recently published in one of the Society's clinical journals. Welcome again to Endocrine Feedback Loop for our ninth episode. Today, we tackle an article in the calcium and bone arena for the first time, one that may help guide the care we provide in primary hyperparathyroidism. Analyzing this article from the JCENM through the lens of its study design will help us get a much better understanding of the results, so I look forward to getting to do that today. As usual for the Endocrine Feedback Loop podcast, two excellent endocrinologists join me today for our discussion. As a brief reminder, I host Endocrine Feedback Loop. I work as a general endocrinologist at the Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville, Tennessee, where I am one of the program directors for our fellowship. Our regular contributor today is Alan Dalkin from the University of Virginia. He has an extensive background in endocrine education, having been the program director at UVA in the past for many years, having served on the residency review committee for the ACGME, and helping the Endocrine Society develop many educational products, particularly the Endocrine Self-Assessment Program, the ESAP, that many of you all are familiar with. So along with a clinical expertise in calcium and bone disorders, he is well-suited to help us learn from this article today. As an aside, Alan was instrumental in getting this podcast started, and I wanted to make sure to thank him for that today. Today's guest expert is Dolores Schoback from the University of California, San Francisco. Her research focuses on secretion of parathyroid hormone, and she is internationally recognized for her clinical expertise in calcium and bone disorders, making her the ideal expert to join us today. Everything we discuss will be our opinions only and not necessarily those of our respective institutions or of the Endocrine Society. Our article today is Use of Preoperative Imaging in Primary Hyperparathyroidism, which was published in January in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. David Broom at the Cleveland Clinic served as the first author. I will now turn things over to Alan, who will lead us through the key points the authors make in the introduction, in addition to helping us understand several key aspects of primary hyperparathyroidism. Alan?
Thank you, Chase. That was a very nice introduction. I appreciate it. Let me begin by kind of running through some general points to make about primary hyperparathyroidism. It's a very common condition, relatively well recognized by most endocrinologists, oftentimes picked up in asymptomatic patients, such that the laboratory evaluation starts with the finding of hypercalcemia in an otherwise clinically doing well patient. Generally speaking, the diagnosis is relatively straightforward and the treatment is relatively straightforward. We'll talk about those, but occasionally it can be more tricky. Occasionally there can be issues that relate to the management of patients that will have multiple adenomas or multiple gland hyperplasia that does make surgical management of those patients that require surgery a bit more complicated. I would say one of the points that we often make to fellows and to learners is that the diagnosis of hyperparathyroidism is really one made by biochemistry, made by endocrinologists, and has to be done ahead of time before one would send anybody to see a surgeon for surgical evaluation or surgical treatment. I think it's critically important to establish hypercalcemia in the face of an elevated parathyroid hormone and the absence of some of the other secondary factors that might otherwise cause an elevated PTH level. I guess it would be reasonable at this point, hopefully Dolores can chime in here in terms of how she stresses this to learners and what the importance of the preoperative evaluation is for these patients.
Absolutely. Hi, everybody, and thanks for having me. Thanks for the introduction, Chase. It's nice to be here to talk about my favorite glands. So I totally agree with you, Alan. It's a biochemical diagnosis, and you really need to be on very firm footing biochemically before you really even embark on imaging and pre-surgical planning. And that's really how I view the imaging. The imaging is done not to make a diagnosis. The imaging is done when you are doing pre-surgical planning. So you've already made the decision that that individual has some reason to be considered for surgery. And there's quite a few of them, of course, but we really want to rest that decision making on a very firm diagnosis, and you don't want to be tripped up. You don't want to be tripped up by a patient on thiazides or lithium or some of the other, or bad kidney function, some of the other reasons for an elevated PTH in the absence of a problem with calcium balance itself. So agree, the diagnosis needs to be carefully made.
Right, and I think that a patient that has mild hypercalcemia and no end organ issues such as bone loss or nephrolithiasis or any of the other matters that we'll probably touch on during our discussion, but by some chance had an outside, say, ultrasound that showed an enlarged gland, that wouldn't change the decision whether or not to send them to see the surgeons. It's entirely based on what I think are well-recognized and sort of time-tested criteria that suggest things that would be remediable given surgical care.
So, absolutely. And I think the other thing to mention it while we're talking about, you know, how carefully to go after this diagnosis before you embark on imaging and surgery and so forth, is make sure that you rule out familial hypocalciuric hypercalcemia. We've all seen cases where that wasn't carefully done and problems definitely can occur downstream from that. So a careful assessment of calcium clearance by the kidney in these individuals, particularly the kind you kind of alluded to, healthy clinically, but mildly abnormal biochemistries, make sure that the urinary calcium excretion is looked at carefully.
So given patients that one would consider sending to surgery, I can say at the University of Virginia, we oftentimes start with ultrasound. Parathyroid ultrasound is one modality. SPECT imaging is another. Generally, we reserve 4D CT or CT scanning with contrast for second or third surgeries. Doris, what do you generally approach, or how do you generally approach, given the patient that you think would be a surgical candidate, surgically remediable disease, what are the options that you have available to you?
We've got a lot of options, and I wanted to actually start out by saying that I think one of the real assets of working in an endocrine center with good endocrine surgeons is that you really approach these patients, particularly the milder ones and the trickier ones, with a team approach. And so we work very closely. We have, you know, three or four top endocrine surgeons who do these surgeries, and we work very closely. So it's the approach that we all take kind of together. And that is just what you said, Alan, really. The ultrasound is always our first step. And generally, we'll do a sestamibi with SPECT as kind of the second step. I generally, if I've talked to the patient and the patient is a good candidate for surgery and meets an indication that we both agree is worth trying to remedy the hyperpara, then I'll usually order both imaging studies as a preamble to a surgical referral. And that's what my surgeons will want done. Our surgeons actually, you know, all of them do their own ultrasound in the office. Generally, when they see the patient in referral or consultation, they're going to do their own ultrasound. And they put a lot of trust in that. Similar to the paper that we're going to discuss shortly, they put a lot of trust in what they can image with their own hands, with their ultrasound. So that's how we start.
I think that's going to lead us quite well into the article. Let me just ask you one other question. Generally speaking, I can tell you at the University of Virginia that if imaging studies are negative, the surgeons will do a four-gland exploration. Given a localization with one of the imaging modalities, they tend to not do a four-gland exploration. I know we're going to come back to this. I want to turn and discuss intraoperative PTH assessment, things like that too. But do you prepare patients preoperatively for the general approach of four-gland exploration no matter what, or is it more focused than that?
Well, I mean, if they truly have nothing localized and you feel that they are good candidates for surgery and they want to have surgery for whatever indication that they have, our surgeons will do a four-gland exploration. They're very comfortable doing it. They're very skilled at doing it. They'll use intraoperative PTH while they're doing it. And they move from one procedure to the next very quickly. The patients are consented for both procedures, even if the imaging is iffy. I always talk to them about it. It's only a patient who has a very clear-cut single gland on the ultrasound, and there's a co-registration with the sestamibi where I say, I think you're going to get through this with just a minimally invasive procedure, small incision, short time in the medical center. But most of the time, we leave open the possibility that the surgeon may need to do more based on what happens in the OR.
Right. So I think the point to make on this is that there has to be some flexibility in preparation of the patients, and that if there's a way to do a smaller surgery, more limited surgery, and we feel that there's the possibility of a cure with that, then that may be the way to go. But I suspect for the listeners today, they can sense that there's some variability in the approach a little bit here and some differences in terms of how the patients are readied for the surgery. So let me make one other comment just to highlight what the purpose of this article was. Essentially, at a given institution, they took many, many patients and did imaging modalities on all of them, varying numbers of imaging modalities, and then did a retrospective look to see what the concordance of those imaging modalities were in terms of finding the adenoma, identifying the proper overactive gland, and what the surgical cure rate was. So I'm going to then turn this back over to Chase to talk a little bit about the methodology and to kind of delve into that aspect of the paper.
Thanks, Alan. I think after that discussion, we have a much better understanding of why we need more data here. I would say at Vanderbilt, there's a little bit more variability in how the surgeons approach things, but it's a fairly similar approach, despite the fact that we don't have a lot of information in the literature about which imaging modality is the most helpful in this situation. And so I think that really leads nicely into why we need a paper like this. We don't have enough information. A lot of what we do has just been the way we've done things. And so we certainly need more data to try to help us understand that. So I think that's where this paper nicely fits in to try to provide that. As I alluded to in the introduction, we want to think about the study design that's used here and reflect on some of the standard terminology and how what the authors use here fit into that, because I think that really helps us understand some of the challenges that the authors had to wrestle with, some of the decisions that they had to make with the data that they had, and what we should be looking at and how we should be interpreting that. So as a quick reminder about a retrospective cohort study. So first of all, a cohort study is one to where you have a group of subjects, that's your cohort, that share at least one thing in common. And as you'll see in this study, it's that thing in common is that they have primary hyperparathyroidism. And you split a cohort into at least two groups, and an exposed group and an unexposed group. And then what makes it a cohort study is that you follow those individuals over time. So there always has to be a time component. And then what makes it a retrospective study is when you get all of your data. Retrospective studies collect all of their data after that time component has occurred, after those patients have been followed. And why that's really important is with retrospective studies, almost always you're left with whatever data is available. It's a pretty uncommon scenario to where you can go back and collect additional data that's not already available to you. Prospective studies have the advantage of they can often define what type of clinical information they want to obtain. Retrospective studies, rarely is that the case. So, and the other thing we want to think about is exactly when we say exposure and outcome, what we mean by that. And exposure, I think, here is the more important one to pay attention to. And when we think of exposure, often we think of that as a clinical exposure. Maybe it's something in the environment. Maybe it's a medication you're exposed to. Maybe it's a gene that you are exposed to as a part of your genome. But really, exposure can be almost anything. And we'll look at what it is here. And thinking of that really carefully, who's exposed and who is not exposed. I think another really important component of that is the non-random nature of it. In randomized clinical trials, it is random exposure to whatever the agent is that you're interested in. In observational studies, it is not random. Something, or in this study, someone is deciding who gets exposed and who does not get exposed. And that's going to be really, really important as we think about that exposure and why someone might have been exposed. So now let's dive into the methods of this particular paper now that we're thinking about that. So this study ran from 2004 to 2017 and is at the Cleveland Clinic Health System. And these are all adult patients who had primary hyperparathyroidism. They initially identified these subjects by ICD codes, but then went back with a chart review to confirm that that was an accurate diagnosis. To be included in this study, all of the subjects had to have both preoperative labs. And so the preoperative lab was to confirm that they had primary hyperpara. But then they also had to have 6-month postoperative labs. And that was so that they could confirm whether or not the subject was cured with a surgery, because that's what we're going to look at. We mentioned outcome before. That's what they're going to care about. So you could only be included if you definitely had the diagnosis, meaning they knew you were for sure a part of the cohort, and also that they had those labs after 6 months so they could say yes or no, this person was cured. And the imaging that was used, the preoperative imaging that was used, was recorded as a part of this study. Now, the authors do point out that sometimes this imaging was done outside of their own system. And so I did think it would be helpful for Dolores to give us her thoughts on this, particularly as we think about maybe some studies that have a technical expertise, like some functional imaging or certainly ultrasound that has some user limitations depending upon experience. Dolores, any concerns that some outside imaging was included here, or maybe not such a big deal in this study?
I'm not so concerned that it was included in this particular study. I think that, you know, in talking to our surgeons about how they handle all the outside referrals that come from outside the system and radiologists and nuclear medicine radiologists that they don't know, what they generally will do is look, first of all, they do their own ultrasound. So in a sense, if it's an outside ultrasound, they do their own and they rely on that. And that's the same as what was done in this study in the Cleveland Clinic. They used their own ultrasound as the standard against which to judge whether a cure had taken place. Now, with respect to the sestamibi scanning, what our surgeons will do is, sestamibi takes time, it costs money, it's not an inexpensive study. And so what our surgeons will generally do is have a good look at what gets brought in by the patient. The study needs to be reviewed by the surgeon. The surgeon is going to make decisions based on whether the study's localized, and so the quality of the study is going to be looked at. If it's really of inadequate quality, then it may be repeated. But as a rule, they are not just immediately repeated, because the study may be in fact valuable.
Good, that's helpful. So we'll list here the different types of imaging modalities that could have been used. So first of all, ultrasound, and just like Dolores mentioned, the vast majority of these were in-office studies by the surgeon. The other one was just a plain technetium sestamibi. The third option was a sestamibi SPECT with iodine subtraction. Fourth could be a CT, or fifth, a 4D CT. So we'll take a look at these and how often each of these were used in the results section. So there is a typical surgical protocol that is used at the Cleveland Clinic, and that is outlined by the authors. And the way that is usually done is that most individuals undergoing surgery have two imaging modalities. So they have an ultrasound, and then they also have a sestamibi SPECT. And then that is followed, again, in most cases, by a foreground exploration with intraoperative PTH measurements. And these are always done by a high-volume surgeon in that healthcare system. So I thought it would be helpful to think a little bit more about this. Alan's alluded to this already, but really thinking about the value of imaging, preoperative imaging, if you are going to have a foreground exploration with intraoperative PTH measurements regardless. And so I think we want to be thinking about that, of why that might be helpful, but then also just thinking about the fact that surgeries are done in the hands of very experienced high volume surgeons at the Cleveland Clinic, and how that might affect the generalizability of these results. And so Dolores, why don't we start with you? Just any thoughts on either of those issues and how that needs to affect how we think about these results?
Absolutely. I mean, we do it quite differently at UCSF, and I want to assure you that I did check in with the head of our endocrine surgery section to make sure that I'm not misrepresenting the endocrinologist's view of what goes on behind closed doors. But basically, we are not doing, as in this study, we're not doing 96% of cases with foreground exploration. You can take advantage of the fact that you get localization with these studies in a fair percentage of patients, and with the added ability of the intraoperative PTH to be very helpful, you can do minimally invasive surgery in a good percentage of these patients. And our surgeons tend to get to do a minimally invasive procedure in about a half to two-thirds of the patients that get referred in as first-time de novo primary hyperpara. So it's a very different approach. And it's really what you feel comfortable with. And I know some of the background of the Cleveland Clinic studies that they really did not feel that the intraoperative PTH offered enough to feel like that made a big enough difference and that they felt that looking at the four glands was the best way to go. But not every surgeon does that. What do they do at Virginia, Alan?
Our surgeons have great respect for the recurrent laryngeal nerve. I think that's a simple way of putting it. And so if the imaging study localizes, they will do a limited or a focused surgery with intraoperative PTH. If the PTH levels don't decline, then they've consented the patient, just as you pointed out earlier, for a more extensive surgery, and we'll go and inspect the other glands. But if there's a 50% or greater drop in intraoperative PTH levels with resection of the gland that was identified by preoperative imaging, then that's the end of the procedure right there. So four gland surgery, I think you said 50% is about right here as well. That's about the percentage of people where either once the gland of choice, the identified gland is visually inspected, it doesn't turn out to be the case, or it becomes clear that the intraoperative PTH levels don't change, about half of the time you need a more extensive surgery. That's exactly our experience as well.
Yeah. So they plan it very differently from the approach by the Cleveland Clinic, yet you can hardly argue with the tremendous level of success here. So there are many different ways to approach this problem. And I think working with the team that, you know, your radiologists and your surgeons, best way to go, what they feel most comfortable with.
Yeah, and as we go through the results, we're going to think about that. Dolores has alluded to it, is that the outcomes that these surgeons have are extremely good. That I think, impacts several different aspects of how we interpret this study. And it is, as you would expect, that at a good healthcare system like the Cleveland Clinic, but it does have a big impact. And what their protocol is, I think, is important for when we think about how do we apply this data, is having to understand, because just like has been outlined already by Dolores and by Alan, what our surgeons do here at Vanderbilt is also a little bit different. And so you can't automatically apply for a different group that has a certain protocol. You can't assume that certain aspects of their findings are immediately applicable to your institution if the rest of the approach is not the same. So I think that highlights that. We've got to keep that in mind as a potential limitation. Nothing wrong, just like Dolores said, there isn't anything incorrectly done here, but it does potentially limit the generalizability. Okay, so now we're going to think about the exposures and the outcomes. And this is a part that gets a little bit tricky, and I think it is important to pay attention here. And so this is thinking about the exposure. So again, going back to that terminology of cohort, you've got an exposed group and you've got a group that's not exposed. And so thinking about what exposure is here. And this is, Alan mentioned the word before, and we'll want to define it, but the authors use the term of concordance here, and that's the exposure. So what concordance is if you had preoperative imaging that correctly identified what the surgical and pathological findings showed during the surgery, then that was a positive exposure. So it wasn't just, did you have an ultrasound or did you have a cystomibi, but it was, did that ultrasound that you have show you exactly what you found during your four gland exploration? And only if the answer to both of those were yes, would you be considered to have had concordance. So that's an important thing to think about here. The outcomes, I think, are a little bit more what we expect. And that was what I mentioned before, is looking at surgical cure based on those labs 6 months after your surgery. And so 6 months after your surgery, if your repeat biochemical assessment showed that you had normal levels, then it was determined that you were cured, and then split into groups based on that outcome, cured or not cured. So a few more things to think about before we wrap up the methods here. And it's thinking about this issue of concordance, and we'll come back to in just a second, I think, why the authors had to do this. But is this really our question that we want the answer to? Is it really whether an imaging is concordant with surgical findings as an exposure, or is it maybe does the ultrasound or whatever imaging you use, if that's your exposure, what is the outcome perhaps defined by what is found on surgery or on pathology. So Alan and Dolores, why don't you guys give us your thoughts on what is our real question here, and then we'll come back to maybe why the authors had to choose this as their exposure.
I guess I would say, what would I want to know about imaging in de novo hyperpara? And what I'd love to know is, can we cost effectively, you know, use one imaging modality and get this kind of terrific cure rate and success? But that would require kind of a different study design, and you know, you need to power it appropriately. You'd have to randomize patients and so forth, and it's a very different study. You need a lot of funding to do it, et cetera. So what we have, I think, is a real, and it's valuable. It's a real world experience with using a protocol with talented people executing it, and how does it turn out? But it answers a different question. So I don't have a problem with the concordance and the outcome. What I'd really love to know is whether there is a superior modality of imaging that could, you know, streamline the process and be a little more cost effective.
And I wholeheartedly agree with that. And I would say the other, I would prefer to find out which imaging modality correlated with cure. But I would also add, and one thing that we can come back to when we discuss the article in general after the data has been presented, I would love to know, in a patient that has a negative ultrasound, was sestamibi superior? And if so, then what is the patient profile that says maybe you shouldn't use ultrasound first, or you should lend more weight to the findings on the sestamibi scan for this particular type of individual or individuals? Because I think that what Dr. Schoback is saying here is cost effective, less radiation, safer for the patient, quicker, cheaper, all those things matter. And it would be nice to have, with such a large pool of patients that have had such a substantial number of imaging studies, what is the sequential approach, as well as the approach of doing multiple imaging studies preoperative, then retrospectively looking back to see what was right.
Right. Yeah.
And I agree. And I think that maybe the question we want to know is which one would be better at identifying what a foregland exploration might show or what a cure might show. And I think the challenge here, and again, this goes back to a retrospective design, is that you don't have control because all the data is what it is. And in this situation, Alan will walk us through the results here shortly, but over 95% of the subjects were exposed to multiple imaging modalities. And so you don't have, say, roughly 50% of your population exposed to ultrasound and roughly 50% of your population exposed to a sestamibi scan. Maybe in that situation, you could really start to drill down on that. But when you have a protocol like what they use at the Cleveland Clinic, to where almost everybody is going to have multiple imaging, then it's very difficult to figure that out. And so I think that illustrates some of the challenges with a retrospective cohort study and why you have to be careful about these decisions. And I think probably why the authors ended up going with defining exposure like they did. So we're going to keep that in mind because we're going to come back to that again as we go through the results and the discussion. And Alan's going to walk us through some of the results and we'll think carefully about what that showed.
The first point to make, there are, I will editorialize at various points as I go through the data in terms of things that I felt were a little odd or a little off or had minor or even sort of moderate to more significance in terms of how I look at the data. There were 1,485 patients involved in this study over the course of the 15 or whatever it was years that the data was gathered. That's a substantial number of patients. The average age is 66. The majority of the patients were Caucasian. The majority of those were women. So I think the patient population in that regard is pretty typical of at least what I've seen here. It probably varies from place to place, from center to center, but I don't think they were far off in terms of who they were evaluating. One concern I did have, though, the average calcium level of the patients that went to surgery was 10.9 milligrams per deciliter. I tend to not send patients with a calcium of 10.9 milligrams per deciliter if that's the highest calcium that they have on record. Generally, those are people that are probably not surgical candidates maybe yet. Some of them do progress, a minority perhaps. but I tend to observe them. The PTH level is clearly elevated in this cohort of individuals, but the PTH level doesn't tell me one way or another whether somebody needs to be considered for surgery. So I would have liked a little bit more information in terms of whether some of these people had hypercalciuria and what happened to that, whether some of them had declining bone density or renal insufficiency or peptic ulcer disease. There really isn't a lot of that information in terms of what it is that drove the surgical or imaging then surgical approach to these patients. The imaging studies were also not evenly weighted. The vast majority, well, essentially the totality of patients had ultrasound, as was identified and discussed earlier here. And then quite a few of them had sestamibi SPECT, almost all for that matter. The CT and with and without contrast, 4D CT and such, those were in 2-3% of the patients. So you're comparing vast numbers of ultrasounds and sestamibis to other imaging modalities that are done less frequently. The surgical cure rate of 94.1% is very good. Dolores alluded to this before. Our institution is probably closer to 90%, although I would say that's partly defined by the fact that there are patients that 2 to 5 years later will develop hypercalcemia and recurrent disease, and this study ends at 6 months after the original surgery. So it's a little hard to compare apples and oranges in that regard, but they clearly have excellent surgeons and have done a very good job in terms of trying to define at a reasonable, 6 months being a reasonable time after the surgery, that calcium has been restored to normal. The majority of them are adenomas, although they had 20+% of individuals with hyperplasia. That's a bit high. At the University of Virginia, I think that the number of patients with multiple gland adenomas is greater than the number of patients with multi-gland hyperplasia. So that is a little different. And generally speaking, the majority of patients with hyperplasia tend to have genetic syndromes predisposing them to hyperparathyroidism, whether it's MEN or which we probably will talk about later. So I think the distribution of disease is a little different than I'm used to seeing, but still the predominant situation was a single adenoma, which is true for most all of us.
But Alan, you know something? When I read this, I thought about this a long time because I thought they're seeing something very different from what I'm seeing in San Francisco. And I think what this reflects, because we don't have the information here, is it's called biochemically cured. Two glands have been removed. We don't know for sure that each one of those glands was actually contributing 50-50 to the PTH hypersecretion. The surgeon does a four-gland exploration, inspects everything, identifies everything. This one looks a little bit funny. I'm going to take it out, and I'm going to take out two glands. So I don't know if those numbers really change my view on what the true pathology of this disease is, because I don't think we don't know that every single one of those glands was over 90% hypercellular or even how big they were. You know, all we know is that two glands were removed and the patient was cured. You don't know whether that second gland was really contributing to the disease or the third, et cetera. So that I think the numbers are skewed based on the approach that was taken here, which was to inspect every gland. And you've got this chance to cure this patient. So if something looks abnormal, you're probably going to have a lower threshold for taking it out because you're there, particularly if the intraoperative PTH may not be changing quickly enough and you're wondering, is there residual tissue that's overactive?
That's a perfectly good point. I absolutely agree. I would say that at the University of Virginia, there's a number of sequential intraoperative PTH measurements that are done. You take out the first gland with the pre and post PTH levels, nothing changes. You move on to the second one. And I think you can then start to establish what the contribution of a particular gland is. It's not perfect, of course, but it does give you some idea in terms of it, the PTH secretion from a particular gland.
I think that nicely illustrates how you collect your data, if you want to use it that way. If you're doing a four-gland exploration, how that can then affect the results that you get, to where if you're collecting your data in a different way, how you might find different numbers there. So yes, thanks, yeah. Dolores, for pointing that out. I think that really nicely illustrates that point.
Just while we're on it then, Dolores, what percentage of patients that you send to the surgeons have calcium levels below 11 milligrams per deciliter?
Well, I mean, you've really already said some of the mitigating factors. I mean, we don't know the rates of kidney stones here. There were quite a few young patients here. The cut point was 18 years old. So age would be a criteria in a sizable percentage of these individuals as well. We don't know clinically what other criteria they met. That would have been nice to know, just to better understand the population, but we don't know. So I would say calcium is a driver for referral to surgeons, but certainly not the only one.
Right. It would have been nice to have said this bucket of patients qualified because of age, this bucket of patients qualified because of calcium, this bucket of patients qualified because of hypercalciuria. But right. that information isn't in
yeah.
there.
Yeah.
So the associations that they found between concordance and cure, cestamibi was concordant with cure in 95.9% of patients, and certainly was similar, although perhaps a bit better in terms of positive predictive value to the ultrasound. So we can discuss a little bit about doing the two of them together. They did not discuss, in my opinion, one of the issues here, they did not discuss the discordance between cestamibi and ultrasound, in other words, in what patients that the cestamibi was negative or was not concordant with the surgical cure gland, was the ultrasound better or vice versa? So Doris, if you wanted to comment on that, I think I found that interesting. It just doesn't tell you what a negative result necessarily means.
Yeah, no, we see discordance a fair amount of time as well. And I guess, ultrasound can certainly be negative glands, buried deep in the neck. I mean, the ultrasound certainly can only really image the neck properly. Cestamibi can go beyond that, can pick up some ectopic locations, can go into the mediastinum. So they are telling us information about different parts of where these glands can be. And so I'm not surprised that the cestamibi could outperform the ultrasound a bit because of just the limitations of the technology.
One thing I'd say is that when we look at, because again, it's the exposure is concordance, which they've defined as your imaging is the same as your surgical pathology. That in total is your exposure. But if you look at, well, how often did that actually happen? How often did the imaging actually predict what you saw in surgery? And with the cestamibi, it was only 44% of the time. So it usually didn't match. So if it did match, yeah, that was very likely that you were cured. If your cestamibi showed that you had two glands and your surgery showed that you had two glands and you took them out, almost 96% of the time you're going to be cured. But the problem is that if you're trying to use these results to say, well, which imaging modality is better to use, it's hard when your exposure actually as a part of the definition has a surgical result in it. And so again, when you think about it, well, it's only concordant 44% of the time. So I think that makes it really hard to know what to do with that.
That's an excellent point. I do think that the other point that the authors were trying to make was that ultrasound cestamibi was a sufficient preoperative evaluation, that adding any of the CT-based modalities to that was not helpful, was not additive in terms of the ability to drive a concordant outcome. I would say, though, as I pointed out before, that the number of patients that had the third modality is a pretty small number. It's not balanced in the sense of the N being similar to the cestamibi and ultrasound. So it's a little limited, but that was one of their primary conclusions.
And I would say another point is not only was there not many patients or not many subjects who had that third imaging modality, but here's where I think we have to think about the non-random nature of the exposure is it wasn't a random selection of who got that third imaging modality. So if we think about it, if we had a protocol and everybody got two and only a small percentage of people got three, why would anybody have had a third imaging modality? And if you think about it, from why might you as a provider have ordered one? Probably it's because you had conflicting results or there was something that made that surgical case more challenging that you felt like you needed more information. So I think we have to be really cautious about concluding that a third imaging modality doesn't help. because I think only the most challenging of cases got the third imaging modality. So I don't think there's the same starting place there as well. So that would probably would be the biggest point of disagreement that I would have is, yes, the concordance numbers are lower in that situation, but it's not the same patient population. It's a unique subset of your overall cohort that you're talking about here. And I think that may be the driver of the lower numbers, not the fact that a third modality didn't help you any.
Well, I would say locally here, the use of a 4D CT or a third imaging modality comes up for people that are having multiple second or third surgeries that right. they have persistent or recurrent disease. And we rarely go past two imaging modalities preoperatively. If somebody needs surgery and neither the CESTA maybe or the ultrasound is giving you clear results, or they disagree, the two results are disparate, I think surgery happens, and whether we've talked about how many glands are examined and such like that. But I would say in people that are having second or third surgeries, especially if there's been three parathyroid glands removed, to take out the fourth is a big undertaking. And those people definitely wind up with a third imaging modality prior to surgery.
Although, you know, I agree with you, and that's our approach, and that's our you know, our spot for use of the 4D CT, for example. But there certainly is a movement in this field to use this as the first imaging modality. There's enthusiasm out there for it. Small, but, you know, a vocal group that really feels that the 4D CT might be the best first imaging study for hyperpara. I just put that out there because you do get patients who come with their stack of articles telling you that, you know, why aren't you doing what's really the most, you know, contemporary way to approach this disease?
And the authors point that out very clearly in the article. I do not know what the cost to a patient of a 4D CT scan is versus an ultrasound versus a CESTA maybe with SPECT imaging. Both of the nuclear medicine tests compared to ultrasound are more expensive and more time consuming. But I don't know, maybe you do, Dolores, what the actual cost to the patient is.
I can't put the dollars on it. I don't know. And it always varies from institution to institution. But supposedly the Sestamibi is more expensive. Just about, you see that quoted all the time, that it's more expensive than the 4D CT, quoted as an advantage of it, that it'll be less expensive to the patient than the nuclear medicine and faster.
So let me just wind up here with just a couple other points. And this is, I have to say, has been my experience as well. For patients that have multiple gland disease, all of the imaging modalities are performed less well. They have less sensitivity to pick up a specific adenoma or adenomas, because there's going to be multiple glands involved. So they are just limited in that regard. And that's true for all the different imaging modalities that were studied. And for a single adenoma, at least in this article, the ultrasound was more sensitive but less specific than the CESTA maybe in terms of its ability to detect the disease. So I think that sums up the high points. Chase, maybe if there's anything else that you wanted to add to that, feel free, or we can move on to the discussion.
Yeah, I think those are the key things. And I think that last piece of information that Alan went through is, I think, really helpful information. When I think about what was most helpful, most valuable in this article, that's certainly up there towards the top, is thinking about the diagnostic performance of these, and knowing that specifically with an adenoma, ultrasound's a little more sensitive but less specific than sestamibi. But just like what Alan pointed out, with multiglandular disease, all the modalities are fairly insensitive for that. They are specific, so it's helpful if it finds it, but the insensitivity is a problem whenever we have those individuals. All right, so what we'll think about now is we'll move on to the discussion and the conclusion, and we'll start with some of the conclusions that the authors come up with, and then we'll add some of our own thoughts on top of that. So two big points that the authors make. So their first conclusion is that two imaging modalities should be recommended as the initial preoperative imaging, and they conclude that combination of ultrasound and the system maybe SPECT is that would be the best approach based on their data. And then second, they say that adding a third imaging modality doesn't improve the cure rate. So I think a few thoughts, and we've touched on some of these already, but just to wrap them up here, I would say when you look at the data as it's presented, particularly trying to decide how many imaging modalities should be used, with the results that the author showed, there doesn't seem to be a difference in cure is whether you use one, two, or three modalities. And my thinking about that and trying to figure out, well, why would that be the case? I suspect it has a big part of that is because almost all of these individuals, I think it was over 96% of them, had a foreground exploration. And my suspicion is that's what's really driving the cure rate and why we have trouble seeing a difference in how many imaging modalities are done, because at baseline, you're being cured so well. We've talked about this already, but that third modality, I think we do have to be cautious in concluding that it's not helpful because of what patients that was applied to in this study. And I do think that helpful data showing about the sensitivity and specificity, that's relatively good with the single adenoma, but with multiglandular disease is particularly insensitive, I think is helpful to know here. So one thing I want us to think about is a possible implication. So if we look at, well, how often did the ultrasound predict what you were going to see on surgery, and how often did the sestamibi predict what you're going to see on surgery? At least according to the data here, the ultrasound only predicted what you were going to see on surgery 54% of the time, and the sestamibi only predicted it 44% of the time. And to me, when I look at all the data, and the authors did a great job of presenting quite a bit of their results here, I thought that might actually have been the most helpful piece of information. And it made me wonder, and I wanted to get Alan and Dolores' thought on this, is if we really don't match up that well, then should a foreground exploration be a standard approach, not a backup approach if your PTH doesn't fall? So what are your thoughts on that, Alan and Dolores?
Well, I think you said in that last little phrase, you said if your PTH doesn't fall, and I would completely agree with you in that situation. I think you hit the nail on the head there. But I think looking at this in the sequence of events, that is that you have an ultrasound or system, maybe you're both localized, and you have the option for intraoperative PTH testing, I think that's what drives the exploration of the remaining glands to some lesser extent. The intraoperative PTH is certainly not perfect, but again, it's additive with the other information that you have preoperatively. So foreground exploration in itself isn't particularly worrisome. It doesn't cause any particularly higher morbidity from the surgery, and it doesn't add a vast amount of time to it. But I think that if you can limit the surgery, the recovery seems to be a little better, at least in most of the patients that I have, it's a little quicker. People seem to feel better about it in that regard. And I think you've disturbed the anatomy a little bit less. Dolores, what about you?
No, I would say I agree with almost everything you've said, except a little bit, Alan, in the sense that these are experienced surgeons, but everybody's got a rate greater than zero of nerve damage and hypopara. And those are not, those can be quite significant, including permanent hypopara. So the more surgery you do, the more extensive the surgery, the more extensive the exploration, even by experienced surgeons, high volume surgeons, there's going to be a percentage of those patients that'll have a complication. Whereas if you can get away with a minimally invasive procedure, maybe you haven't even touched the other side. The recurrent nerve has not been touched. The other two parathyroids are fine. So I think that trade-off, potentially doing the chance to do less harm, is important, and I think is important to patients.
Yeah, and I think that use of that intraoperative PTH, as was usually done here, can certainly help you avoid that in many situations. And as we talked about already, it's possible that that's also contributing, in addition to a standard foreground exploration, is those measurements really helping to drive the good outcomes that we're seeing here. And Alan, you mentioned before you had a potential question or an uncertainty in your mind about thinking about different gene testing early on to try to help figure out perhaps the likelihood of, if you can't localize, or if you're worried about the possibility of foreground hyperplasia that might actually necessitate a foreground surgery. And so why don't you elaborate on that a little bit more?
Well, I think I will do so. But before I get to that, I want to reiterate what Dolores said back at the start of this, which is that I think that the most common pitfall, which is a genetic issue, is familial hypocalciuric hypercalcemia. So I do think that it behooves all of us to make sure that patients are not missed, that we screen everybody in terms of their urinary calcium excretion rate, just to make sure that this is not a calcium sensing receptor mutation. Those are more common, I think, than I gave it credit historically. And there's a fair number of patients that turn out to have pretty reduced urine calcium excretion rates. And if you wanted to find the mutation, I bet you could. I don't usually go any further than that. But those people certainly should not be sent to the surgeons. They are only going to get worse if you make them hypopara.
Right.
And they will have foreign disease. Doris, want to comment on that, since that was your point earlier on?
Oh, no, I do think that it's really important. It behooves us to make sure that we haven't taken those patients to surgery. But also, Chase, you're bringing up a really important point, which is what's the proper workup of the whole spectrum of patients that come in with hyperpara. And I have to say that we do tend to think repeatedly about patients who don't localize and are younger. And you may or may not have a family history, but the urinary calcium is on the borderline, or it's low, or it's often low and occasionally normal. We've seen all kinds of combinations of these things. And I do think that we have to, the approach has to be pretty sophisticated before we even come to referring to surgery, thinking carefully really about, how can I get tripped up here? Because I'm bound to step into this trap if it's here. And be really, really careful about the diagnostic workup, because I think we're seeing more and more, as surgery is more successful, patients get referred with milder and milder biochemistries, and it can really be a challenge. And we're certainly getting referred a lot of normal calcemic patients to be dealt with. And thankfully, that wasn't part of this, because that's even a trickier group to have any solid comments about.
There are many patients that are having PTH levels checked for reasons that I cannot fathom. And once that's elevated, it begets a whole series of referrals and other questions. It's also amazing to me how many patients you cannot find a prior calcium level that was normal. It's yes. Such a simple way to rule out FHH in many regards, but there are people who literally do not have prior labs that you can find, and they're younger, but they're not so young you can't believe that they would have primary hyperparathyroidism, but you don't have a previous calcium. You have to do the urinary studies in those individuals. You just have to be sure.
I have to share with you guys, because you're clinicians. So this week I heard from one of our pediatric endocrinologists who wants to proceed with sestamibi scanning in a 15-year-old, in the sense that the PTH is elevated, the calcium is elevated, and not genetic testing, not anything, but looking very aggressively for localizing the disease. And so I think we have to really stop and go back to basics and really make sure that we understand pathophysiology, or get the best understanding we can, and genetics. And what was interesting to me, just like what you just said, Alan, this teenager had been evaluated for developmental delay and had not had a full chemistry panel. This was the first calcium value ever obtained.
It's hard to believe sometimes. So
yeah.
The other, I think where Chase was going with this too, was also talking about menin gene testing. Mm-hmm. And I would say, and again, Doris, your experience in this would be very helpful to review too. I don't do much of that, except in rare situations. The last time I can remember was it was years ago, but it was a young woman who was a freshman in high school who presented with nephrolithiasis, with a kidney stone, and then had hypercalcemia on her labs. And it turns out I now have three patients, because I have her younger brother and her father.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And sure. So in that case, it was very helpful to test her. Her father had hypercalcemia. That was easy. But then we tested her brother, who did not have hypercalcemia, but did have the genetic abnormality and eventually did manifest with hyperparathyroidism. So that situation, I found it very helpful. But the vast majority of people, I have not ordered gene testing preoperatively. It doesn't, except, as you said, I think you said young, family history, those kind of situations maybe, but generally speaking, run-of-the-mill primary hyperparathyroidism patient, I don't do it.
Yeah. Well, no, I completely agree. We would be wasting an awful lot of money doing that, but certainly there are situations and patients with recurrent disease, certainly not first time de novo parathyroid primary hyperpara. Do we lower the bar for that testing? Kind of some of the scenarios you've described, Alan, I completely agree with in terms of doing genetic testing. And the younger the patient, certainly there have been some series that have looked at patients under the age of 40 who present, patients under the age of 45. Your pickup rate for screening for, you know, hypercalcemia genes is going to be very significant, you know, 20%, 30% in that range, which are real numbers when they present. But it's usually more than just the first time hyperpara. We're not doing that.
And as we think about wrapping things up here, where we want to end up with is considering whether these results should change the care that we provide. So I want to think about that, kind of the study overall, and if it's going to affect what we do. And I'll give you quickly my thoughts. I mentioned it earlier, but I think actually one of the most important things that I saw in this was that how actually pretty poorly the ultrasound and cystometry correspond to what is seen by the surgeon in the surgery. And so I think that certainly gave me much more of an appreciation for when our surgeons are perhaps skeptical of some of the imaging and how predictive that's going to be, is to say, well, yeah, even at a place like the Cleveland Clinic with great surgeons, great endocrinologists, great radiologists, is that it's in the neighborhood of 50% is either of these imaging modalities going to tell you at least what the surgeon is going to see in the operating room. So I thought that was awfully helpful, a piece of information in addition to some of the other data that the authors presented.
I would agree. I also think one of the things that I would have liked to have known or liked to have seen related to, given a negative imaging study, what is the other imaging study? How does it perform in that situation? And I think in the Venn diagram of life here, the 54% and 44% may not have been the same population of patients. It doesn't get into that. There's no way to know. So given the two together, what's the summative identification rate, I guess, is how I look at it.
I agree. I would have liked to have seen that, and it didn't seem to be. And there's a lot of numbers in this paper for sure, but it didn't seem to be there. I guess, you know, if you're doing a four-gland exploration and you're finding multiple glands in over 40% of the patients, you're going to call an ultrasound that localized one gland or a cestamibi that localized one gland as non-concordant because the findings were different. So I think we have to keep coming back to the fact that the approach is an institutional approach based on very sound endocrine surgery principles and interpretation of the data. But it is going to color how the results on this kind of an analysis come out. It's hard to get away from that the approach is prepared in advance. You know what the approach is going to be, and you're looking at retrospectively how these different radiologic procedures performed. And when you are going to be proactive and go ahead and do a four-gland exploration, they're going to underperform because if they did localize, that's not going to be counted in their favor, so to speak. I think it's hard to escape the retrospective nature of this data, the data generation.
And with that, I would like to thank Alan Dalkin and Dolores Schoback for joining me for this month's edition of Endocrine Feedback Loop. I learned a great deal today and know you all did as well. Please join us again next month. And now you're in the loop. This has been Endocrine Feedback Loop. Endocrine Feedback Loop is brought to you as a members-only benefit of Endocrine Society with special production oversight by Maggie Graham.